Refugees and border walls, woke celebs and socialist chic, social engineering and COVID lockdowns. It's easy to get wound up over what's happening in our country and in the world. That's why it's time for Act and Unwind, a weekly roundtable discussion tackling current events from the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. Every Monday, join host Eric Cohen and Acton Institute experts, including Dr. Samuel Gregg, Reverend Robert Sirico, Dr. Stephen Barrows, and more in this weekly audio public square where news, politics, religion, and culture meet for an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. Act and Unwind will explain the news of the week through the Acton Institute's unique perspective, connecting good intentions with sound economics as it works to promote and to shape a society that is secure, free, and virtuous, one characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. To subscribe to Act and Unwind, visit acton.org/NR or search Act and Unwind on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are available. That's acton.org/NR. To subscribe, please check it out.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Satyricon by Petronius. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. This episode is brought to you by the Subtext Podcast, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a few minutes. Our guest is Kyle Harper, a professor of classics and letters at the University of Oklahoma. His books include The Fate of Rome, as well as From Shame to Sin, and his latest one, brand new, from Princeton University Press, is Plagues Upon the Earth, Disease, and the Course of Human History. He joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Kyle, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Hi, John. Greetings from Norman, Oklahoma. Thanks for having me.
Why is The Satyricon by Petronius a great book?
Well, I do think it's a great book, and I teach with one of my colleagues here a course that is actually based on a course that W.H. Auden taught at the University of Michigan in 1941. And we take a few liberties with Auden's syllabus. And this is always one that I love to include on a great books list. And it sometimes surprises people, including students. But I think the case is strong that this is one of the great, really, it's not right to call it a great book. It's a great fragment of what must have been an amazing book, because what we have are only bits and pieces of what would have been originally a really sprawling novel. And the longest complete fragment that I think we'll spend most of our time talking about is the one that everybody who's read this knows and remembers, is The Dinner Party of Trimalchio. And I think it's great for many reasons, including as somebody who's interested in the social life of living in the Roman Empire. It's probably one of our most vivid portraits of people in different conditions, slaves, freedmen, elites in the Roman world, in a kind of realistic mode of depiction. But I think it's actually so much more than that. It's a story that really gets at the meaning of life, of how humans can confront the reality of our mortality. And it does so in a way that's pretty unforgettable, that's obscene and exaggerated, and has had an enormous literary impact, despite the fact that we've lost most of the text.
We're going to talk about all that, the fragmentary nature of this work. Of course, we're going to focus, as you say, on the dinner party of Trimalchio. We'll talk about what was life like in the Roman Empire at the time this book was written. And of course, we'll get at least a little bit into the dirty bits, Kyle, the obscene parts of The Satyricon. I love to start these podcasts by reading the first line of a work, but here we can't, because the first line of The Satyricon is missing. What we have is a partial text, much of it lost. What remains is fragmentary. How do we as readers approach such a thing? And is this work incomplete? Is it frustrating in that sense? What are we to make of it?
I'd say it's tantalizing, because what we have is so extraordinary and so unique. And to first put it in perspective, what we have are little bits and pieces from maybe about a dozen different chapters that are, you know, 50, 70 pages, 100 pages of text in a modern edition. And we think that this is about 5 or 10% of the original scale of the work. So we're forced to judge it based on, you know, imagine if you only had 5 to 10% of Moby Dick or Brothers K, because this must have been originally a work on that sort of order of magnitude. And we've only happened to have this tiny little fragment. And it sort of reminds you that as good a job as the ancients and medieval scribes have done in preserving for us so much great literature, and they really did often have good taste and good judgment, there's simply some things that we've lost. And some of the lost great works we barely know of, but this is one where what we have hangs by a thread, and unfortunately, we've lost 90-95% of it. So as readers, I say we're tantalized, because the bits we do have are clearly the work of a genius, somebody who's a master of prose, who draws vivid characters, and it's hard to call something in the history of literature unique, but I think certainly in the panorama of classical literature, there are things that we can compare Petronius to, but really the portraits that we have, the style and the content of the dinner party of Trimalchio don't map very easily onto anything else. This is really a unique work, a work of genius that I think is very arresting when you are confronted with it.
It's a work of prose, as you say. It has some poetry, but it's primarily a work of prose. It's sometimes called the first novel. Is that a good way to look at it, or is that an anachronism to think of this as a novel?
I certainly think it's a great question, and it's one of the really interesting questions of literary history broadly, and it's an important question to try and get at. So I would personally be convinced if you wanted to argue that the novel is really a modern thing. And, you know, however we want to get at it, where you want to go back to Cervantes, or you want to locate it more in the 17th and 18th century with people like Defoe, or with works like Pamela. I think there's a lot to be said for understanding the novel as an art form of long prose, realistic fiction that gets at the inner lives of the main protagonist. Rising in a bourgeois world of broadening literacy and expanding sentimentality, I think that's one of those meta narratives that has a lot to it. But what then do you do with what are sometimes called the ancient novels? So texts that include the Satyricon, the Golden Ass, and a body of texts known as the Greek Romance, because these are long prose fictions. I think they are best all considered romances. And they're romances in that they're stories of adventure and they're stories of love. And I actually would be a champion of the literary merits of many of the ancient Greek and Latin romances. So texts like Daphnis and Chloe are really beautiful stories about a boy and a girl who fall in love and the world tries to keep them apart. But they ultimately, love wins, and they come together, and nature reproduces itself. And despite all of our follies and all of the faults of the world, life goes on. Love wins. The Satyricon is making fun of that. And I think we know enough to say that this is actually a spoof on romances that must have been circulating by the time Petronius wrote this.
The longest extant part of the work is this dinner banquet hosted by Trimalchio, and we'll jump into what that's all about in just a moment. Is that complete, that section of it? Do we have it all, or most of it at least?
Yeah, that section is basically complete.
Okay, so here we have Trimalchio, the host. We meet him first through the eyes of the narrator of the Satyricon, a guy called Encolpius. First of all, who is he, this protagonist in some sense of Satyricon?
Unfortunately, one of the strange facts about this work is that we don't know as much about the narrator and protagonist as we do about this one character who looms over the longest section, Trimalchio. But Encolpius is he's an affluent, educated, kind of a drifter or a parasite, might be a better term for it. So he's one of these people who could sort of successfully move throughout the Greco-Roman world on their education and culture, but he certainly doesn't impress us as a figure of great moral values or cultural achievement. He's not a narrator that you sort of identify with or fall in love with or sympathize with. But Petronius nonetheless gives us a panoramic view of life in the Greek inflected Latin towns of the Bay of Naples in the mid to late first century.
How does he meet Trimalchio?
So the main character and his former lover, student, friend, Ascoltus, and their slave, Gaetan, are sort of drifting around the Bay of Naples, and they have what we would call, if you'll excuse a terrible 21st century term, a frenemy named Agamemnon, who's a rhetorician, another teacher, and they ultimately get invited via Agamemnon to a dinner party that's held by Trimalchio, who's a wealthy freedman. And this is a kind of social category that is really at the center of this portrait, and that we really have to kind of make sure we explain. In the Roman world, there's a lot of slavery, and the Roman slave system practices extensively manumission. So in the Roman world, there are a lot of slaves, and there are also a lot of former slaves or freedmen. And a tiny minority of these freedmen were either close enough to their masters that they inherited money. Many of them were educated from the Eastern Mediterranean, and they served as kind of accountants and business managers for wealthy senators. So a tiny subset of freedmen were extremely wealthy. And this is a social reality in the Roman world. We know quite a bit about these wealthy freedmen. And in Roman social terms, they were kind of a paradox because they lacked status. So freedmen were inherently considered low status, but they had wealth. And Trimalchio really embodies that paradox of being wealthy but of low social status. He's the ultimate wealthy freedman.
And so what's he like as a guy? He's vulgar. He's extravagant. He has a lot of money, as you say. What else do we need to know about Trimalchio as a character?
Well, he's gauche. And, you know, we think we all nobody knows a Trimalchio. At least I hope you don't know anybody who's quite like Trimalchio. But you may know people who, you know, they somehow want to let it slip how much their car cost or how much their house cost or their vacation cost. And so what for us would be a kind of a social fault or faux pas is sort of the essence of Trimalchio. He wants you to know through every act he takes and everything he says what an amazing person he is. And he has triumphed against the odds. He was a slave. He was abused. He rose through the ranks of his master's slave corps, was ultimately freed, inherited a bunch of money, lost it, he tells us, and then invested it again in risky commercial enterprises and shipping, and made a ton of money. So he's, in our terms, he's sort of a billionaire. And he wants you to know it. He'll tell you about it. He'll tell you about his properties. He wants to be able to move from southern Italy to Africa without with stepping only on his own land. He has so many slaves that he can't count them. He has so many properties that he hasn't visited them all. So he's absolutely gauche. He's crude. He thinks he's cultured, but he's, of course, horribly uncultured. His poetry is terrible, cringeworthy. And, you know, there's nothing more cringeworthy than bad poetry or somebody reading their bad poetry. And, of course, Trimalchio does that. So he's the ultimate sort of socially gauche figure, nouveau riche, who wants you to know how wealthy he is.
So how does that make for a good story? We have an obnoxious host. We have these guests. What happens?
Well, it is a good story. They go to dinner, and the scenery from beginning to end is just sort of constantly over the top, outdoing itself. And from the second you meet Trimalchio, he's playing some kind of, he's big, fat, wearing these rich red gowns and jewelry, and he's playing some kind of ball in the yard of his villa with his slaves bringing him the balls after they fall. When he needs to dry his hands, he uses the hair of one of his slaves. This is sort of their first image of this amazing character. They walk through his house, and the entryway has what in Roman terms would have been a kind of unbelievably socially improper mural that shows Trimalchio's rise from the time he was sold as a slave through his manumission and his successful commercial ventures. And then they sit down for a long dinner, and the dinner is, who knows how many course dinner, in which every new course involves some kind of opulence and some kind of just obscene level of luxury that's served by the most outlandish group of slaves that ultimately takes kind of a first turn when Trimalchio has to go to the bathroom. And of course, he describes in detail what he's doing. And eventually, he just encourages the guests just to use basically piss pots at the table. And the group of largely freedmen sitting around the dinner table start to talk. And it's vernacular Latin. It's kind of an everyday, coarse, vulgar Latin that represents the kind of chatter of people living in a Roman city, complaining about the price of bread, gossiping, scandals, who's died, what their lives were like. And ultimately, you realize that this is a story about life and death, about how much pleasure can you get from life, can you wring from it before you die. And Trimalchio is obsessed with his own mortality. He's obsessed with really wringing every last drop of pleasure that he can out of life before he dies. And ultimately, the kind of arc of the story, one is that it gets darker and darker as they get drunker and drunker, and ultimately sort of climaxes in a really wrenching, violent encounter between Trimalchio and his wife, and then ultimately proceeds towards the kind of mock death of Trimalchio. He has his will read out, which of course is just as inappropriate then as it would be today if some wealthy person decided to have their will read out so that they could enjoy it while they were still living, and then ultimately descends into a kind of mock funeral for Trimalchio, and that's sort of the narrative arc that ultimately is the culmination of the story.
You're listening to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review, and this episode is sponsored by the Subtext Podcast. I'd like to tell you about that now. If you love the humanities, but you're not so much a fan of listening to lectures, then try the Subtext Literature and Film Podcast at subtextpodcast.com. In each episode, philosopher Wes Allwyn and the poet Aaron Olonek explore life's big questions by way of an in-depth discussion of a great work of fiction, film, drama, or poetry. In the tradition of a liberal arts seminar, Subtext focuses on the insights into the human condition that make these texts timeless, insights that can change the way we view ourselves and live our lives. Recent episodes include conversations about the relationship between imagination and ambition in Shakespeare's Macbeth, how to square honor and justice in the film The Godfather, the connection between the political and the spiritual in the short stories of Anton Chekhov, the power of art to persevere in Percy Shelley's poem Ozymandias, and the developmental psychology of magic in The Wizard of Oz. So if you love close readings of great books and film, go to subtextpodcast.com or search for Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. That's subtextpodcast.com, S-U-B-T-E-X-T podcast.com, or search for Subtext on the podcast app of your choice. Kyle, the Satyricon is funny. It's got a lot of humor. Is there a particular scene you love that you can share with us?
Oh, that's a great question. There's so many different moments in the dinner that are kind of arresting or hilarious or unforgettable. And Trimalchio loves a trick of the eye. So he loves to serve dishes that make you think it's one thing and then it turns into something else. And at one point, he makes you think that he's serving a wild boar that the cook has goofed up on and forgotten to eviscerate properly. And So when they think that he's about to beat the slave, he tells the slave to cut it. And in fact, he's not just done it properly, but he's done this sort of unbelievable dish as these luxury gourmet foods pour out of the pig's belly. So the scenes of the different kind of plates that are served are pretty amazing, but I actually think the most what makes it great literature is really the words of Trimalchio himself, and you can tell that he's an unsettled person. He's a damaged person. He's a person who's experienced great abuse and hasn't escaped the trauma that it brought to him. And I actually think the final scenes in which he lashes out at his wife and then gives a kind of self-rationalizing speech are, to me, the most memorable and powerful part of the entire scene. And he tells you his story, but it's not just the highlights of his story. He tells you that for 14 years, he was basically subjected to the abuse of both his master and his mistress. And he tells you there's no shame in doing what the master orders. And you can at the same time tell that he doesn't even maybe fully believe that or come around to that level of acceptance. He's really scarred by the experience of slavery. And yet he's surrounded by people that he holds enslaved. So he's, of course, continuing to perpetuate the institution that had really defined his life. And he's not particularly attractive as a slave owner. There is such a thing, but he's violent. He's exploitative. And so it's this really amazing representation of a slave who'd been freed, who is in turn a master of slaves in a really vivid and kind of brutally violent way.
So what are we supposed to learn from all of this? What are the transcendent ideas that come across in this work that is so often vulgar and obscene and ridiculous?
Well, I think we have to remember that that Petronius is maybe doing two things. He's talking to other artists, and he's also talking to philosophers. So Petronius is talking to other artists, and that he's spoofing the idea at the heart of all romance, which is that our nature as humans, as creatures that are capable of love, will ultimately redeem us. And this is not a story that seems to offer that kind of redemption. And so it's in some ways a really dark parody of the ideal of romance, that we are part of nature and that our ultimate destiny is to be redeemed through finding love, procreating, and continuing the cosmos. And at the same time, it's talking to philosophers. And remember, the two dominant schools of philosophy in the world of Nero, the world of the Roman Empire, where this was written in the 60s, are Stoicism and Epicureanism. And it's to Petronius's great credit that nobody's ever been able to pin him down. And sometimes people think that this is a Stoic text that's making fun of the hedonistic ideal of Epicureanism. Sometimes this is actually thought to be an Epicurean text that is sort of upholding the Epicurean idea that the physical pleasures are sort of a false road that just lead to addiction and ultimately to decadence, and are upholding the Epicurean idea that the kind of pleasures we need to pursue are refinement, friendship, culture, artistic beauty.
How do you deal with those parts of the book in the classroom? I remember I had to read this book in a great books course as an undergraduate, and I found parts of it shocking. And it's not a book you would assign to, say, high schoolers even. It's bawdy, and that's maybe the most euphemistic way of putting it. It also has pornographic bits. It deals with homosexuality, even pedophilia. How do you deal with these questions as they come up in a classroom with this work?
Well, it's a very relevant question, and I've taught it several times, and it certainly is one where you, I think, as a teacher, have to be cognizant of the fact that this is a story that really does represent people who've lacked autonomy over themselves and who've been subjected to some of the most exploitative systems that the world has ever created. And I think it's why Trimalchio's really an ambiguous character, because of course he's gauche and exploitative, but he's also a person who'd experienced the worst system of exploitation that the world had maybe ever seen up to that point. So I think you have to prepare students or readers to be ready to grapple with the fact that the Roman world was a very complicated place, and that slavery was an integral institution in this world. And this is a world of gladiatorial combat. This is a world where the entire system of sexuality presupposed the existence of a huge number of people who didn't have any voluntary choice over what happened to them or their bodies. And Christianity in the first century is reacting to this. The Greek Romance is reacting to this in calling for a world where people choose who they marry and choose to align their sexuality with marriage and love and procreation. But this, there's a lot of reality, gritty, brutal reality in this text. So it certainly is obscene, and it really does present to us a world where there's a lot of rape, there's a lot of abuse, and there's a lot of pedophilia. And that's something that the text really does confront.
This is a work of literature, and we can study it as a work of literature, but also has tremendous value to historians as a glimpse into what the ancient Roman world was like. Tell us a little bit about that. What do we learn from the Satyricon about the ancient Roman world? And I should point out, you're an expert on ancient Rome. Your new book is Plagues Upon the Earth, Disease in the Course of Human History, which draws upon your research into disease in the classical world and expands it throughout human history. But what do we know about ancient Rome from the Satyricon?
Well, I would say if you could only pick, you know, one or two texts that really represented life in the Roman world, that you might pick. Well, first I'd pick The Golden Ass by Apuleius. I think that's one of the most extraordinary portraits of life in the Roman Empire. But this would maybe be next. And obviously Trimalchio's exaggerated, and the Romans didn't really sort of live like this on a day-to-day basis. But in those exaggerations, there's a lot of truth. There's a lot of truth in the codes that governed Roman life, from the way people dressed to the way people ate. These were sort of social rituals that really did define the nature of human relationships in the Roman Empire. So here it's being exaggerated and twisted and inverted, but the vividness of what you wear was closely regulated and was an expression of your place in the world. And we see some of those codes played with and inverted here in a way that's simply extraordinary. It's a story about life in the urbanized world of the southern Italy, the Bay of Naples, in the first century. It's a world that's, to use our word, multicultural. And we've really come to appreciate that simply to survive life in these cities was hard, and the population of the cities would have constantly gone down because of the poor health environment if they hadn't been constantly replenished by immigrants and slaves. And so a place like Rome, a place like Puteoli in the Bay of Naples, would have been constantly refreshed by the influx of people from without. Many of those people were from North Africa, from the Eastern Mediterranean, from even beyond. And so it's a world where people had to make their own identity. And it's a world where there's a lot of danger, but also there's a lot of opportunity. And I think that's what the story of Trimalchio is about, and it's what Petronius is getting at. And there's really very few texts in the Roman Empire that give us such a gritty sense of what life was like in one of these open Roman towns of southern Italy.
The Satyricon, of course, was written in Latin. If our listeners want to try it in English, is there a translation or an edition that you would recommend?
I'm partial to Sarah Rudin's translation. I think it's both accurate, but also gets at some of the literary qualities of the text and some of the things that Petronius is doing. It's not the easiest text to translate because parts of it are in sort of stylized literary Latin. Parts of it are in poetry, as you said, and then parts of it are vernacular. And so Petronius is trying to catch the voice of freedmen and slaves, and does so in a way that we almost have no other examples of. So it's not a text that's super easy, but Sarah Rudin, who's beautifully translated several works of Latin into English, has given us a very good version of this.
Sarah was a guest on this program. Episode number 44 in the Great Books podcast series was Confessions by St. Augustine, which Sarah also translated, so you can check out that. The Satyricon has had a real influence on modern literature, Trimalchio particularly. How so?
Well, I think it's a testament to how powerful this fragment is that it's really its influence is actually pervasive. You start looking at, you know, people who've drawn something from Petronius or been sort of struck by the character of Trimalchio. It testifies to the power of that he's left so many traces in modern film, of course, but also in modern literature. And one of the great novelists of the 20th century and I think the greatest poet of the 20th century were both really struck by the power of Trimalchio as a symbol. And so the novelist is F. Scott Fitzgerald, who for a long time wanted to call The Great Gatsby Trimalchio in Westag. And this is a commendation for editors everywhere that he wasn't allowed to do that. And I think it was his editor who said it needs to be something else. And they came up with Great Gatsby, which is frankly a much better title than Trimalchio in Westag. But it's telling because the story of Gatsby is really in some ways thinking about Trimalchio and the kind of figure of Trimalchio as a kind of socially mysterious, self-made, extremely wealthy person who becomes a kind of social impresario through using their wealth to let people pursue pleasure in the kind of darkness of night and the limits of hedonism. So there's a direct link, a direct line from Petronius to Fitzgerald in the figure of Gatsby. That's pretty amazing.
And he mentions he actually uses the figure not in the title, thank goodness, as you said, but in the text itself. The line from The Great Gatsby is this, quote, "It was when curiosity about Gatsby was at its highest that the lights in his house failed to go on one Saturday night, and as obscurely as it had begun, his career as Trimalchio was over." Unquote.
Beautiful. I'd forgotten that. That's great. So it's still in there directly.
The other great authored influence you mentioned was one of the great poets of the 20th century, T.S. Eliot and The Wasteland. What does Trimalchio and the Satyricon and Petronius have to do with The Wasteland?
Well, correction, the greatest poet of the 20th century, but the one of his, you know, canonically great poems has as an epigraph a quote that is straight from the mouth of Trimalchio himself. Trimalchio is sort of, he's only half drunk at this point, but he's bragging about the things that he's seen and done in life. And the Sibyl at Cumae was a kind of famous mythological priestess in Cumae, which is on the edge of the Bay of Naples. And the report of Trimalchio says that when he sees the Sibyl, she had famously asked for eternal life, but hadn't asked to be ageless. And so she just keeps aging and aging and aging. And in the words of Trimalchio, he saw her and she says, "I want to die utterly," in Greek, apophanen thelo, "I want to die utterly." And so T.S. Eliot used that at the beginning of The Wasteland. And this story of decadence and disillusion and kind of all the things that The Wasteland is about, somehow Eliot really found expressed in the kind of combination of the Sibyl's eternity and her sort of meaninglessness. And he found that inspiration, and so much so that he puts it at the head of The Wasteland. So it's, isn't it really an amazing testimony to the power of this little fragment that both Fitzgerald and Eliot found something so worthy about it?
Last question as we wrap up. That's all very interesting that the Satyricon influenced Fitzgerald and T.S. Eliot. But what's the case for reading the Satyricon now? The thing is almost 2,000 years old. Can it teach us something special today?
I mean, I think the questions that it's asking and the issues that it's dealing with are timeless. It's about death, and it's about the contrast between pleasure and the reality that it will come to an end. And Trimalchio is a really fundamentally unphilosophical person, and I think we all want to believe that that we're not like Trimalchio, but there's something very human about him, and he represents a kind of repressed fear of our own end, and the kind of hedonistic impulse that is somewhere lodged in human nature is here sort of exaggerated in such a ludicrous sense that that, you know, you want to say nobody is like that, but there's something really just fundamentally human about Trimalchio, and the way Petronius paints this character, I think can really still speak to the timeless questions and the contrast between different kinds of pleasure and the reality that we're all going to shuffle off this mortal coil someday. And so I do think it's worth reading, even in our very different world.
Kyle Harper, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Satyricon by Petronius.
Thank you, John.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.